Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, a Tuesday afternoon. Thanks very much for tuning in. On Wall Street, what's going on? Dow has just dipped into negative territory, not so much. The NASDAQ up 12 and the S&P 500 down a point. The Dow actually up a few now, so it's been on either side. John Najarian joins us on Tuesdays. Maybe you watch him on CNBC. I do, just ahead of the show every Tuesday, and then he comes to talk to us. John, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Well, great to be with you here, Steve. Thank you.
So I looked up at the monitor, and you guys, during your show, the Halftime Report, right? Is that the correct name of the program?
That is, sir, yep.
I'm sorry.
CNBC every weekday at 11 until noon Central Time.
I'm remarkably prepared until the moment I'm not. But, yeah, so CNBC is on, and I watched you guys, and the crawl on it had to do with McMaster. And it kind of goes into what I want to talk to you about a little bit. It seems to me that there are times when you've got big news, political news in one way or another, and that would sort of show itself on Wall Street. I don't know that the Russian meeting news from last evening into today showed much. It struck me that the Comey reaction on Wall Street wasn't all that much either. Now, I'm reading there's one theory that we're in this pretty strong earnings report, and that's sort of buffeting the rocky political news. But I just wonder what your take is on all of that.
Well, I guess it's multi-pronged. Number one, I think that one of our great writers over here at CNBC penned an op-ed that said it's pretty much like a coup going on in the White House right now. Combination of these leaks. I mean, you know, you're in a private meeting with various Russian officials, private in that, you know, McMaster and I believe Rex Tillerson at least were also part of that same meeting last week. But to have somebody leak that, what was said in that room out to any press, let alone the New York Times and or Washington Post, is a bad thing. It shows that somebody is trying to basically tear the president apart from inside the White House, which, you know, should be concerning, as concerning as many of the statements that were made about whether or not he broke the law, which he didn't, of course, and so forth. But I think overall, the reason that we're able to dismiss so much of this is the more the agenda gets pushed off, Stephen, the more there's that invisible hand under the market. I mean, when and if we get the tax reform and or the infrastructure spending and or reform of Dodd-Frank or the Affordable Care Act, I think all of those are going to be positives. And most of us in the markets would say very positive for the market going forward. And so do you really want to be out of the market if that's still looming, if that's still out on the horizon, even if the horizon got pushed out a little bit?
Is the idea of tax reform and all of that tax cuts already put into the market? I mean, I wonder if they don't happen. They're not in the market, just the hope of them.
Not my feeling anyway.
Okay.
I've heard from various folks, they say, probably a couple points on GDP, not full points, but maybe between 0.25% and 0.5% for GDP as far as what the impact of that will be. But when you have all four of those topics that I named, it could be a pretty substantial boost to our gross domestic product, to consumer confidence, industrial production. I mean, there could be a whole bunch of things impacted positively by this. So I think that's why when we see dips, you know, whether it's 40 points or 100 points in the market, it comes back nearly the same day. It's not because of manipulation. It's because there's like a seller's strike. There's nobody really there to supply what the rest of the world wants to buy.
Okay, stay with me on this one. Sometimes I know I tax your patience, but
No, you never have.
I read something last week, and the sort of the rationale for not a big drop or spike after the Comey firing was they said, well, the Republicans, this actually makes tax reform or the tax cuts come that much more quickly because Republicans are worried about 2018. So that means the tax reform bill will be speeded up. So Wall Street, in a way, liked that. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
And in fact, we had a very animated halftime report today. I actually had to tone it down because I got a little carried away.
Oh, I missed that.
But we had Ron Insana, who's a dear friend. He was on from Washington, D.C., and he was saying, you know, how these things push off the agenda and that could mean that Democrats sweep into the various Congress, whether it's the House or the Senate. And I said, it completely false, that narrative. Now, there could be a number of things that derail it, but if indeed you have the agenda pushed off until 2018, are you telling me that with tax cuts and with repeals of various regulations that I've described, that that's going to be bad for the Republicans? I'd say just the opposite, that that's momentum for them going into the election. So that's the way I choose to view it. Time will tell if I'm right, but that's really what I would be saying to the president if I were his advisor.
All right, Ford's making some news today. I know there's some target earnings news today. What are you watching?
Well, I really liked the way Advanced Micro Devices, after their earnings just over a week ago, AMD is the symbol there, it broke down hard. It got all the way down to under $10, and now it's back over $12, $12.40 right now. Those might not sound like big moves, Stephen, but you know, when you see a 20% move or more out of a stock, that's big. I would take similar action on stocks like Nike, and or a stock like TJ Maxx, TJX, because I think TJ Maxx is going to feast on the various bankruptcies of some of the smaller retailers like Rue 21 and BB and some of the excess inventories at Macy's and all other areas. I think that is going to be huge for them. So I'd be a buyer of TJX on the dip.
John Najarian, great to talk to you again on this Tuesday. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
You can follow John on Twitter at John Najarian or watch him on the Halftime Report on CNBC. All right, it's 12:18. Andrew Herman will be here a little bit later. Talks about openings and closings from DNA Info. And, well, we've got macaroni and cheese on the menu. It's 12:22. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. And Andrew Herman is in the studio from DNA Info. He comes by to talk about openings and closings. And, well, you just can't talk about macaroni and cheese only off the air,
right?
On the air, I should say. So we were going through a little bit off the air, and you are a macaroni and cheese guy.
Oh yeah, yeah. As I was saying, I started eating this macaroni and cheese with lobster. You see it on menus here and there, and
right.
It came as a side dish. I didn't even order it.
I mean,
once.
The lobster sounds good, but it's still macaroni and cheese. I mean,
it's not the stuff out of the box, Steve.
I go back to when I used to eat that stuff out of the box when I couldn't afford the milk. You know, when you're a college student, so I would make it with water.
Oh, and, boy.
So maybe that taints it a little bit.
That's an early bad experience,
but
I think, for you.
But I see these macaroni and cheese, you know, I see the dishes on menus, and I'm thinking, you're going out to dinner. Why would you order macaroni and cheese? And, you know, more and more restaurants, and now there's one, was it up in Rogers Park that is opening?
Yeah, so this is called Midnight Mac and Cheese, 6979 North Sheridan. It's opening on Friday. They have mac and cheese, 36 different toppings.
I saw the sun-dried tomato mac and cheese.
Yeah, I wasn't appealed.
That didn't work for you?
No.
You go straight to the lobster.
The lobster, the crab. They have barbecued pulled pork, grilled steak.
Come on, grilled steak on a macaroni and cheese.
You know, it's all mixed up in there. Yeah, it's just cheesy deliciousness, and it's $6.75 for a 1 pound.
They sell it by the pound.
Yes. $8.25 for 2 pounds, but... the owner of the restaurant says that the anticipation is so high in Rogers Park that he's had to clean the nose prints off the window,
the front window,
because people are peering in there.
So they're opening Friday.
Opening Friday.
I don't know a lot about this neighborhood. Do you? I mean, is it a place that's dying for restaurants?
If it's in Rogers Park, it's within distance of Loyola.
Oh, yeah, right. So close to Loyola.
Macaroni and cheese in college.
Open till 2 a.m.?
Yeah,
those
exactly.
Kids don't know what it's like to have water and mac and cheese.
It is interesting, though. I saw some figures about the consumption of cheese in this country, and it is up 43% in the past 25 years. People are eating cheese like it's going out of style.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. Maybe they think it's pure. It seems like it goes against everything we're after these days, right?
Right.
It's kind of high cholesterol.
High fat,
yes.
Right?
But maybe everyone's treating
themselves. So it's up 43% in 25 years.
Yeah, right.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out why that would be. I mean, it's not the – I don't know why that would be.
I don't know. I mean, other than mac and cheese, maybe they're putting it into other products. I'm not a cheese expert, though. No. I would like to be one.
Okay, well, let's make this segue. Too much cheese, and you could end up at the University of Chicago Hospitals, which is close to the University of Chicago, which is close to the Obama Library.
Right, Right, and if you need to stay overnight, they are building a new hotel there at 60th and Dorchester, 180 rooms, 15 stories tall. And as you point out, it's a block away from the Obama Library, but the university says it's really more about U of C business than the Obama Library.
Well, okay, fine. We'll believe. I'll go check.
Well, they might have something to that because this is part of a trend across the country that campuses are all building new hotels. 14 hotels have been built on campuses across the country in the past 3 years. There's a company in Chicago called Graduate Hotels. They've built 6 hotels at campuses, including Michigan and University of Wisconsin, Arizona State, and they want to open 20 on college campuses by 2019.
Okay, so tell me, because when I first read this story, I thought that the University of Chicago was getting into the hotel business. They're really not, right? It's on U of C land,
right?
But it's going to be privately run,
right? So the details are not out there yet as to what the U of C gets out of this. But this is now common on these college campuses that you have a developer come in, they put up the hotel, and then a company runs the hotels, and then there's some sort of formula in which the universities themselves get a cut of the revenues.
And tuition goes down.
we would hope, but this is evidently a thing on college campuses that colleges feel like they need some decent housing. And for the alumni, it's for people who are taking their kids around to colleges.
Right. Well, you know, I've noticed that going around, and my son goes to Miami. I think there might be one on campus there.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been like sort of almost boutique hotels. This one's bigger than that. But the idea that is a development. And I hope that it's a money maker for these schools because, you know, I do think the schools sometimes work a little bit too much on luxury,
mm-hmm.
not enough on education, mm-hmm. and the kids have to pay for that.
Well, these new hotels all have meeting rooms, and you can have conferences, and you can use your professors as experts, and then you can put on these conferences.
Oh, okay.
So you could attract business people or people in the medical field or any kind of research.
So there's that. The other side of it is, like, here comes more economic development to this area around the Obama Library, right? It's got to
right.
be a good thing.
It just keeps growing. It keeps growing. Once it gets going, there'll be a couple thousand employees, so something needs to support those people in the neighborhood. So you're looking at restaurants and shops and stores.
Know it, you could probably get a good bowl of macaroni and cheese
there you go.
On the campus of the University of Chicago.
We'll get right on that.
Andrew Herman, thanks for coming by today.
Okay.
Thank you, Kim Gordon. 12:37. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Suzanne Mushin is in the studio. She's the co-host of The Big Payoff. You can hear that at WGNplus.com on iTunes and just about everywhere else. Suzanne, welcome.
Thanks, Steve.
Okay, what the hell are we going to talk about?
Steve and I always have these great conversations before we go on. And then the question is this radio content? Or can we have the conversation?
Well, I'm tired of preparing for a conversation with you and then throwing it out the window. It's Women's Health Week?
It is.
What's that about?
What is that about? See, my theory is when they give you a week, you're kind of screwed.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's come up before for you.
Right. And right. So Women's Health Week, here's what I find both troubling about it and also curious. So let's see what you think. So this is this official week that's by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to promote women's health.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the agenda. You tell me if you think these are things that are specific.
Women-centric?
Or that you, Steve, shouldn't be also paying attention to.
Okay.
Visit a doctor or nurse for a well visit.
No, they don't call it a well visit. What do they call it?
Screenings. But well woman visit.
I'm not going to go for that, but I'll go for a well man visit.
Get active.
What?
Get healthy.
Yeah.
Swear to God, this is the agenda. Pay attention to your mental health, including getting sleep and managing stress. And don't text and drive.
So this is patronizing, really.
Don't you think?
I think so, yeah.
I just don't understand why this is a gender-specific issue. And also, in this moment in which we have so much to talk about when it comes to women's health in America and what's going on right now with our health care, this is the agenda?
Okay. Do you understand 3D printers?
Kind of, like enough to know that if I saw one spewing out stuff to say, oh, cool, that's a 3D printer.
I don't know what I can't grasp them.
Yeah.
I really think they're just manufacturing machines that they call printers.
Yeah, I think printer is probably, you're right. I think printer is a strange word to use.
They're machines that build things. Anyway, the journal Nature Communications out with a story today that a team at, where are they? University of Feinberg School of Medicine.
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's here.
Here.
Has created a 3D printed ovary, and that they say it could revolutionize infertility treatment in the United States. It's a gelatinous ovary that has apparently worked in mice.
So they want.
Well, I mean, anything would work.
Anything works in mice. Right. They say that all the time. It doesn't give me a lot. Right. I would not go from works in mice to try this on me.
No,
just for myself. I would not.
There's probably a middle.
Right.
What would the middle be?
I guess the middle would be some sort of like, you know, semi-human species, which doesn't exist.
Well, no, that'd be Men's Health Week.
That's exactly. We could try the ovaries in you. If they'd work anywhere, if they work in mice, why couldn't men give it a try?
They probably could. And
right.
That goes exactly to what we're talking about.
Right.
Because off the air, we're having this gender conversation, which we're supposed to be having on the air. And the MTV Music Awards just a week or two ago had for the first time not a best actor and best actress, but best.
I think it was for music, but it was genderless. The category was just saying it, you know, best fill in the blank. And I was saying to Steve off the air that I believe that weeks like this, National Women's Health Week, Women's History Month, and even dividing categories on the Academy Awards will be a thing of the past.
So you think in 10 years there will be a best performer?
For sure.
Best lead actor? What will we call them?
Probably actor.
Okay.
Right? But they won't say, you know, in best male in a leading role. I think that we will look back on this as isn't that cute? Remember in like the, you know, 20, like 17.
When they
17.
Used to divide them by men and women.
Yeah, remember that?
Okay, and so you're going at it less than why should we compete against why should we compete by gender or within our gender?
Why not
compete wholly?
Right.
But you're also saying that the gender definition is becoming so fluid.
Correct.
That you're not going to have enough women in the best supporting actress or men?
I think it will become not part of our regular lexicon every day to refer to ourselves specifically as male, female, as a gender category. I was saying to you that I'm now starting to get emails where the signature line has in parentheses after a name, she, her.
Okay, say the person's name is Meredith.
Nancy.
Okay, Nancy.
She, her.
So
I swear to God.
So the name Nancy no longer is the indicator. Assigned pronouns that come with it that
correct.
Are the indicator.
If anyone's watching Billions right now, you're watching this character who's in the hedge fund and who wants to be referred to as they.
And you think this is the way of the future?
100%.
So I may well get an email from William that says she, her.
You could.
Or you from Meredith that says him, he.
Right. My understanding from my children who are college age and on liberal campuses is we are not supposed to make assumptions that just because you walk into the room and present yourself as what I may think is male, it's really not for me to judge.
I don't know what's male. What do you mean?
I know. We have this issue all the time.
Right. Well, it's hard for me to. Because I don't see that happening for a while. And I'm all for, you know, people identifying however they would like to.
Yeah.
And if you want the name Caitlin, it's available.
Right. We know that. Not Noah, though.
But I just think that there are Noah girls.
Yeah, there are, NOA. Yeah.
Yeah. Mostly Jewish girls, right? Or Noah
Lots,
girls.
Lots, many.
But I think the population of transgender or cross-identifying or whatever, while they're welcome and encouraged and everything, is still relatively small, that it's not going to make national changes like you're saying.
So if you're going to predict that we're a decade away from that or more, I'm going to say we are 5 years or less.
Well, okay. Which of us will predict we'll be doing this in 5 years?
Exactly.
Okay, Blue Ivy.
Oh, Steve. See, this is what I love about you is that you are so wise and sharp on so many cultural things, but Beyonce is like it's just a blinder you have.
Beyonce?
We planted
Blue Ivy at our house.
I know you were, but here's the thing. So Blue Ivy is Beyonce's daughter's name, which Steve actually convinced me he thought was the name of her dog.
Beyonce and Jay-Z.
Right. Thank you. Did you know that from my notes or did you know she was married to
Jay-Z? No, I knew that. But, you know, it's interesting. We often refer to, you know, like the dad isn't there.
No, that's true. Good point. Well taken.
So Blue Ivy, Jay-Z's daughter.
And they are trying to trademark their daughter's name.
Quit it.
They are.
Well, I can kind of see that. But I could see where they want to protect it because it is a pretty unique name.
I feel that if you go that far to name your child Blue Ivy, well, here's the what will happen, which is what did happen. Someone else has taken that name for something like an event planning company.
And they had it first.
Yes. So don't name your kid something that an event planning company would name their child.
So that's the thing, this Blue Ivy event planning.
Exactly.
Are they suing to try to block the
trademark? I think they're saying that they have ownership over it. And what I find interesting is, first of all, don't you think Jay-Z and Beyonce could probably afford to pay a lot,
right,
if they really wanted the trademark?
Well, yeah. I mean, there must be a way to protect your daughter's name, but not put a pre-existing business out of...
I would like to know that. I mean, for example, Gwyneth Paltrow has a child named Apple.
Right. I'm still eating apples.
Right. Yeah. So I just don't know how far we can go to trademark a name that you've decided, like, you know, the Kardashian, their child is North.
Well,
right. Did, isn't Kim's daughter North?
Was Prince's name protected in any way?
I don't think that was his real name. Remember, he had the symbol for a while.
Well, he was it was his marketing name. So maybe he could protect the marketing name in a way that.
I just think that we're in now this world in which who would have thought that you needed to trademark your child's name? But I guess if you're Beyonce and Jay-Z.
Yeah, well, I have not come across that in my particular
You're life. Not going
to. I'm not going to.
No.
So the homework for everyone is to look for emails that say Bill/she/her.
She, correct.
Or Nancy they? Slash they.
Yes, that's what I'm telling you, that
it
I'm billions.
It can't be a they.
Yes. Steve, there's a whole group of people identifying.
An individual person,
yes,
who refers to her.
Because they're neither, they don't consider themselves specifically male or female.
Let me just
female.
Finish the sentence.
Please.
An individual person,
yes,
who refers to themselves as they?
100%.
Well, I'm sorry, that's a bridge too far. Suzanne Buchan, listen to her and The Big Payoff, WGNplus.com. What else you got going on?
Are you referring to me or they?
They.
What, do we
what
have
else
going
do
on?
You people? Uh-huh. I can't say you people.
No.
I can call you they, though. What else do they have going on?
Well, we have going on. We did a great series recently on our podcast, which tracked Rachel's and my attempt to take a new kind of vacation, where we, instead of saying that we really unplugged and like went off the grid, where we stayed on the grid but felt refreshed.
Excellent. We'll look for that. And we will be right back.
We will.
Homegrown tomatoes. Homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love.
It's 12:52. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, and I'm not lying to you. I've wanted to play that song on the radio for more than 25 years, and this is my chance. Gary Lazarski is on a phone line. He's the CEO of Mighty Vine, right out there in Rochelle, Illinois. Gary, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me, Steve. It's good to be on with you.
If you want me to send you a file of that song, Gary, I'd be happy to do it. Maybe you want to play it on the
in
Instagram?
I do, in fact, want.
Do you think the tomatoes would grow faster?
I'm glad you gave you an excuse. We'll play that in the lobby of our greenhouse when people come to visit.
You know, I love talking to guys like you because, you know, there are words or phrases that come into our head and our lives, and then sometimes they don't quite translate. So we talk about locally grown food and, you know, restaurants wanting to know where the food comes, very sustainable, blah, 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 things like that, important. But then we don't always make the leap. It's like, well, okay, how does a locally grown tomato make it to my restaurant or my grocery store in February? And it's because they're grown inside. And in your case, tomatoes grown inside at Mighty Vine in Rochelle. You guys haven't been up and running all that long, have you?
No, our first harvest was in October of 2015, so we've been selling tomatoes for just over a year and a half now.
And it looks like it's going gangbusters, Gary.
It is. It's going well for us. We've had great support from local restaurants and retailers, and we doubled in size. So we came online October of 2015 with 7.5 acres, and the reception was good enough to warrant us doubling in size to 15 acres, which we're now farming.
And so the new greenhouse, or the increase in size, that's up and running, I know that it was underway.
Yeah, it is. In fact, we started harvesting tomatoes in January of this year.
Oh,
from
okay.
The additional 7.5 acres.
Oh, so I was thinking it was this spring.
In full production.
And so when you're at your peak, you're going to be producing 900,000 pounds of tomatoes a month?
Yes. Yeah, roughly. Roughly there. It kind of, you know, it varies a little bit, even though we try to take a lot of the variation out of the production. If you get several weeks of very sunny weather, you're going to see a flush crop.
And you have no trouble selling 900,000 pounds of tomatoes a month.
No, well, sometimes a little bit more than others, but in general, we've got very strong support from the local restaurant community and retailers in Illinois, Wisconsin, Iowa, throughout the Midwest.
And one of the beauties for Mighty Vine, right, is you're kind of operating on an island. You don't have a lot of competition just yet.
No, in the hydroponic greenhouse tomato business, there aren't a lot of folks by. There's plenty of competition in the market in general, different times of year from different areas. But as far as a high-flavor, premium, locally grown tomato, we've got a good head start.
Do you expect that there'll be competition moving into the market?
Yeah, I would expect that people, I would think some of the folks looking at us and seeing that we've doubled in size are probably wondering if there's something they should be doing.
yeah, I think I'm going to go buy a greenhouse. Just, you know, when the show's over, I'm going to go buy something.
You bet. Give me a call. I can help you through it.
And I have no doubt that your tomatoes taste better than any others in the Whole Foods or any other grocery store. Do they cost more?
There is a bit of a premium, yeah, for local. It really depends. There are, you know, we run our tomatoes on sale just like any other product. The retailers like to do that to bring people in from time to time. So on occasion, our tomatoes will be cheaper than the terrible bland tomatoes that we're all used to. And on other times, they'll be a little bit higher. But the price difference isn't so great to really be prohibitive.
Is it better? I mean, is it more economically feasible for you to grow tomatoes inside during the summer than it would be, say, at a truck farm down at St. Anne or Wichita or places like that? I mean, I just wonder because it seems like you could control it a little bit better.
Right. In the summer, the great thing is we're not spending any money on lights, right? In the winter, we're able to grow year-round because we've got lights that allow us to keep the tomatoes happy. In the summer, our electricity is minimal use. You know, it's just not needed because we've got enough sunlight.
Right.
So we're able to – and then the fact that hydroponic farming has a greater yield per square meter or per square yard – allows us to be very competitive with field grown.
And you do this with less water, right? You do this, it's a pretty green effort.
Yeah, we do it with 10% of the water of field grown tomatoes, which is one of the really sustainable features of the greenhouse.
Do you capture?
Because you're doing drip irrigation, you know, you're applying the nutrients directly to the roots.
Right.
You're not putting fertilizers and all that down into the water table. You know, your listeners and you are probably familiar with people talking about the Gulf of Mexico and agricultural runoff and. You know, some of that is true. Some of it might be overblown, but in hydroponics, you don't have any of that.
We
recycle all the water we use.
I'm a big fan of Brussels sprouts. You're looking into Brussels sprouts at all, Gary?
We don't have any expertise in that area, but if it would work for you, we'll take a look into it.
That could be my opening.
That's it. You could be the Brussels sprout king of Chicago.
Gary, that could be worse. Gary Lazarski, the CEO of Mighty Vine. Hey, great talking to you. I know it was quick, but I hope we can check in again later.
Would love to.